Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne, is at the controls. In this hour, Focus 580, we'll be talking with a journalist who's had many years' experience covering the Middle East. His name is Neil McFarquhar. He served as the Cairo bureau chief for the New York Times between 2001 and 2005. Currently, he is their UN bureau chief. His personal experience in the Middle East, however, goes back some way. He grew up in Libya and covered the Middle East for the Associated Press, spending some time in Israel and Kuwait. We'll talk this morning about his most recent book, which is drawn from his experiences in the Middle East. The title of the book is The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah Wishes You a Happy Birthday. The subtitle, Unexpected Encounters in the Changing Middle East. Public Affairs is the publisher. And it's certainly a product of his desire to tell some different kinds of stories about the Middle East, going beyond the coverage that we get so much of that's about conflict and violence, to talk more about the people that he came to know, to show some sides of the Middle East that we don't often get in the media that we have here in the United States. He's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions and comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I do want to mention, by the way, if you'd like to find out some more about him, he has a website, which is his name, neilmcfarquhar.com. Also, the Daily Beast website, which is dailybeast.com, has an excerpt from the book there right now, starting today. So if you're interested, you can go and you can check that out. And of course, if you'd like to read the book, you can head out to the bookstore or the library and look for it. Questions on the program are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana listeners. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good to anyone that you can anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point, questions are welcome. We just ask people to try and be brief, so we can keep moving along. But, of course, anybody's welcome to call. Mr. McFarquhar, hi.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. Right off, I think I need to ask you, I'm sure at some point always, maybe near the front, people ask about the title of the book. And that's not a joke. You did, in fact, get a birthday greeting from Hezbollah.
Well, Hezbollah exerts a lot of control over the territory in Lebanon that they control. And one of the things they make you do as a reporter is fill out a bunch of forms when you want to work there. And so they ask you where you went to college, what degrees you have, your mother's maiden name, and your birth date is one of the, you know, blanks on the form. So I filled it out, and much to my surprise, on my birthday, I would get an email greeting from Hezbollah at Hezbollah.org, Hezbollah with an I.
Mm-hmm. I suppose that one of the things that suggests, illustrates, is that when you are working as a journalist in Lebanon, or I suppose anywhere in the Middle East, that you being anonymous is just not an option, that you're always going to stand out.
You know, people ask me that question all the time, you know, how was I treated as an American? And I'm a little over 6'3", and I have blonde hair, and so I kind of look like what the Middle Eastern image of what an American is supposed to look like. I kind of fit that image. And, you know, I've always been treated with, you know, utmost kindness and hospitality, with the sole exception of 2003, the year the invasion of Iraq happened, and just people were watching, you know, American tanks or American soldiers fighting in Iraq every night. And then there was some overt hostility. I mean, I never obviously faced the kind that the reporters in Iraq did, where they were, you know, threatened with kidnapping and being killed. But people would say things to me or occasionally throw things at me. But it only really lasted that year.
Yeah. Well, that's it's certainly, being a reporter can be a dangerous job, depending on what you're doing and what you're covering. And we certainly know there have been reporters have been injured and killed. But generally speaking, your experience has been, it sounds as generally speaking, it's been quite positive. I don't know if that's the word that you would use, but in the way that people related to you, both as an American and as a journalist.
Yeah, I mean, I always tell the story. I mean, I laugh about it, because I didn't hide my nationality. I always told people where I was from. And one time, for example, I broke a tooth in Saudi Arabia, and I had to get into, you know, the chair of a dentist I'd never met before. So I was asking him where he'd studied dentistry and stuff, and he was preparing his implements. And he said, "And where are you from?" And I said, "New York." And he said, "New York? American? That's not a popular thing to be. Open wide." Started the drill. But he did a fine job. And, you know, overall, I think, as I said, I never really faced any difficulties.
Mm-hmm. Well, that I guess also that makes me think about the stories that people so often tell about traveling in places where they may think that there's anti-Americanism or where people have been critical of the American government. That is, that people continue to be able to mostly be able to make a distinction between Americans and individual Americans and what the government of the United States does, and that they can be amazingly hospitable to individual Americans, even though they may be very unhappy about what the government of the United States does.
I think that's definitely true. And, you know, they have so little control over their own political process that they really kind of give us the same benefit of the doubt. It's almost like they don't hold us responsible for the decisions of the administration. I mean, that being said, I don't want to gloss over the change either. I mean, there's definitely been much more hostility toward Americans in recent years than in the past. And I tell one story in the book where I check into a hotel in Yemen, and as I'm checking in, the clerk calls the owner and says, "Hey, an American just checked in," and it happened to be the month of Ramadan when Muslims fast until sundown, and it was just like at sundown. And so the owner said, "Tell him I'm sending him a car." And so, you know, this Toyota truck pulls up, and I jump in, and away we go, and we go roaring across the desert. I have no idea where we're going. We get to this little kind of castle in the middle of no place, and the gates swing open, and then the gates swing shut behind me, and I just think, you know, what have I done? And I walk into the house, and it's covered in pictures of Saddam Hussein, and I'm just going, uh-oh. But, you know, he's a completely generous host. We had a wonderful meal. We had a long conversation, and, you know, I went back to my hotel very happy. But I think in this day and age, if someone yelled into the phone, "Hey, an American just checked into the hotel," I'd probably check right back out.
Yeah. Well, that I guess that maybe that's just the kind of thing that reporters do. But I suppose some people would be amazed that you would actually have done that. That is, you would have gotten into the car and driven off, not really knowing what it was that you were getting into.
Yeah, well, I just never really felt a sense of menace. But, you know, obviously, you know, some of my colleagues have paid with their lives since then and doing the very same thing. So I think these days you have to be a little more careful.
Yeah. Tell me about your growing up in Libya.
Well, you know, it was kind of an idyllic childhood in a lot of ways. We grew up right on the Mediterranean, and I went to Esso Elementary School, Esso being the precursor of Exxon, and it was a wholly owned town. So they at one point decided that Libyans were not allowed to live in the town. They had to be out by 5 o'clock. So it was more sort of like Texas on the Mediterranean than it was in Libya. And, you know, I think a mark of our isolation, I used to listen to the news every day with my father at the breakfast table of the BBC before going to school. And one morning we turned on the radio and, you know, the chimes of Big Ben ended. And the first headline was, "There's been a coup in Libya." And we were just sort of like dumbfounded. And, you know, there was absolutely no sign in the town around us because there were no Libyans there.
Yeah. So you didn't really have the chance that you didn't hang with little Libyan boys when you were growing up. There would have been no way for you to do that.
No, there were absolutely none in the town. And, you know, in a way, that's the reason I became a reporter, because I sort of thought, you know, I grew up surrounded by this fence, and I thought, you know, what was on, when I got to college, it was sort of like, what was on the other side of that fence? And so I started, you know, reading the history, and I went back and learned Arabic, and I sort of tried to redo my childhood.
Yeah. And so you left there when you were, what, about 16?
About that, a little earlier. I went off to boarding school. There was no high school, so I came to the States for boarding school.
Uh-huh. And this, you would say that your experience having grown up there, maybe it took you a little bit to get back to it, but that really did influence your interest in learning Arabic, learning more about the history of the Middle East, and then eventually that led you into being a journalist and reporting from there.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of wanted to go back and you know, I think it gave me an empathy and a fondness for the region, because I identify with it as my childhood home. You know, occasionally the New York Times would dispatch me off for one crisis or another. And I remember once they kind of threw me on a plane in New York at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. There was sort of an outbreak of violence in Israel, and an hour after I got off the plane the next morning, I was in this little West Bank village, and the chickens were scratching in the dirt, and there were olive trees all around, palm trees, and I could hear someone reciting the Quran, and this was a little voice inside me kind of said, "You're home." You know, it's always there.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Neil McFarquhar. He served as New York Times Cairo Bureau Chief from 2001 through 2005. He now is its United Nations Bureau Chief. He grew up in Libya, as he just explained, and then after coming back to the United States, going to college, he became a reporter. Then he went back. He worked for the Associated Press covering that region. And his most recent book, which is about some of his experiences as a reporter in the Middle East, the title is The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah Wishes You a Happy Birthday. The subtitle, Unexpected Encounters in the Changing Middle East. Public Affairs is the publisher. Now, questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I think that you explained that your first time back in Libya from having left there when you were in your teens was just after you got the assignment as the bureau chief in Cairo. So you went there and spent a couple of weeks hoping, in some sense, I think, to maybe reconnect with that place where you grew up. Sounds like the government wasn't really happy with your reporting, and at the end of that time, they said goodbye and you're never going to come back.
It was, sort of one of my dreams was to become the, Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times, and I had fulfilled that. And my other one was to go look at my childhood home. And so the opportunity arose just 2 weeks after I got the assignment in Cairo, and so I was all excited. And I got off the plane in Libya, and the Libyan coastline is really beautiful, and I spent all my childhood at the beach. And so we rounded the bend in the road coming from the airport, and I saw that coastline. It was just like my DNA was just jingling. But then the Libyans are very sort of proud of this system of communal meetings. They sort of have these popular committees that meet to decide things, and the whole country shuts down and everybody has to go. So I went to one, and, Gaddafi does these crazy things, like he changes the years. Like the Muslim calendar is based on when Muhammad made the pilgrimage from Mecca to Medina, and that's what the whole world uses. But he changed it to the year of Muhammad's death, so it's 1369, maybe, is the year I was there in Libya, when the rest of the Muslim world, it was 1431, and all these things. So these people stood up and made noise, and the government hated my article, and they never let me back in, so I never got to see my childhood home again.
Mm. There certainly it is the case. I mean, we know that within these countries, there are people who are not happy with their governments, and if, for whom it is very difficult to be a public and outspoken critic of the government, although people do find ways to do that. How difficult was it for you as a journalist to get people to talk openly with you? Because certainly they must know that could get them in a lot of trouble.
It varied from country to country, and from, if the government happened to be cracking down on dissidents at that moment, then obviously people were more reluctant to talk. If it happened to be a minute of openness, then they would talk. The book is kind of divided into two halves, and one, the first half is sort of issues that I think there's a big gap between the outside image and the daily reality in terms of the religion, in terms of TV, and other sort of day-to-day topics. And the second half kind of focuses on men and women, the individual stories of people trying to bring change to the region. And, those people, I have my utmost respect for them because they are incredibly brave. They're fighting terrible odds. There's secret police that track them in all these places. But they're men and women that really do want to make their societies more open, more freer, and I have a lot of respect for them.
Are there particular people, and I know that I think one of the things that you really tried to do with the book is highlight some of these people who have challenged their governments, have said that we think that things that should be going differently. Are there particular people that stand out in your mind that you met as really good examples of at least that impulse, that attempt to say we should be doing something in this country, we should be doing something different?
I think they all There's about a half a dozen people in the book, and I think each one of them is a fine example. You know, one, there's a poet in Jordan named Samir El-Khuda, and he's a civil engineer, but at night he writes poetry, and sometimes he writes political poetry. And, one time he wrote a poem questioning the king of Jordan and by extension all Arab leaders. And, he was thrown in jail for a year. You know, the king and queen of Jordan come over to the United States, and they're kind of photogenic, and they're this great-looking couple, and they talk about peace, and they talk about, moderate Islam, and everybody thinks of them as moderates. But Jordan, like all Arab countries, is another police state. And I think that people that speak out against the police state and push against it are very brave. And, everybody in the book has done that to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose that suggests that certainly there will be people unhappy with the United States for things that we have done. And you talked about the fact that personally that maybe the most difficult time for you as a reporter and as an American was the time after the invasion of Iraq. So for that reason, people will have reasons to be unhappy with the United States. But it sounds as if one of the big challenges for the United States, and maybe it's not something that we understand very well or that the government deals with very well, is that people resent the United States for their support of governments in the region that their own people see as repressive and anti-democratic and violators of human rights, and that we are seen to be supporters and enablers of those governments. And so that's when people think of the United States, that's maybe one of the first things that they think about.
It's true. It's one of the things that kind of saps the credibility of the United States, is that over the decades, the government, the American administration, has kind of gotten away from supporting the little guy and just supports these people that stay in power forever just because they happen to, their policies happen to coincide with American interests. But I think that the United States tried to get away from that a little bit. I mean, in 2005, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice came to the American University in Cairo, and she gave a famous speech saying, we have supported dictators just because they supported our interests for too long, and we've discovered that, with the rise of extremism, because of the lack of political freedom, that it is no longer in our interest to do that. But then, the next sentence was about supporting the king in Jordan, and I mean, the Jordanians certainly know that he has put the brakes on a lot of kinds of reform, so that, immediately people were questioning the credibility of that statement. And also, once Hamas won the elections in Gaza, the Americans kind of backed off that democracy. And the point that I make in my book is you can't make the leap from, these authoritarian dictatorships to democracy in one fell swoop. You got to do it gradually. So what outsiders should be doing is trying to widen the space for civil society and civic rights, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of association, those kind of things.
Yeah, and also though there's another, the impulse might be for the United States to say, well, we see within a particular country, we see people that maybe espouse values that we like, or at least they're the people that are talking about mobilizing for some kind of change. But then for those people, they don't want to be associated with the United States. And so we can't go in there and say, here, we're going to point to this individual that's the kind of person that we'd like to support. You can't, because then that's bad. That's sort of poison for that person to be seen in that country as being somehow associated with or an agent of the United States. So we can't also very specifically back particular people because it's not good for them.
No, but you're right there. You can't, because they're seen as quislings, or people, their motives become suspect. Are they getting money from the United States? Why is the United States supporting them? And they, their opponents use that to try and tear them down. They're a stooge of the Americans. And especially since the Americans' reputation is not particularly high at the moment, that kind of backfires. But, there are principles in Islam and in all those countries that coincide. It may not be democracy, but there's an emphasis on the Quran, for example, in justice, that rules should be just and justice should carry. So you can, there are ways that you can talk about those kind of human values that people will relate to. And I think whenever the United States speaks out, it does have weight.
I know that you've been your more recent assignments were here in the United States, and so you haven't. I don't know how much whether you have any opportunity really to be in there in that region or to talk with people very much since the election of Barack Obama. But from what you've seen, I guess I'm curious about your reflection on how it is that his election was received. And whether you think that that's the kind of thing that really is likely to get people thinking differently about the United States, or you know, how long something like that is likely to be good for, particularly since we're still in Iraq and we're talking about putting more troops into Afghanistan, and we have our issues with the government of Pakistan. How important do you think that was to the people in the Middle East was the election of Barack Obama?
I am in contact to a certain extent, and I like the region enough that I go there on vacation. I haven't been since the election, but I was there last summer, actually, while the candidate Obama was visiting the region. And I think... you know, I think on one level, people were kind of thrilled and excited by the prospect of, you know, an African American and certainly one whose family had roots in Islam being elected. But, you know, that was tempered by the fact that they don't really think that American policy towards the region changes, you know, from one administration to the next. They kind of feel like it has always been a little bit hostile toward the Arab and Muslim world. And, you know, obviously the level of that hostility they felt got much higher with the invasion of Iraq. But I think the president had said two things in his first interview with Al Arabiya, which is one of the satellite channels. President Obama said, first of all, he was going to be listening. And he also said that the United States will promote the interests of ordinary people, the poor and those who lack opportunity. And I think it makes a huge difference in that part of the world if people think that their grievances are at least being heard. I think they sort of felt like they were stonewalled in previous years, and that, you know, that the United States really didn't care what they thought. And just that switch alone, you know, it's not enough to overcome all the suspicions and all the, you know, problems created by Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, but it's a start.
In this hour of Focus 580, we're talking with Neil McFarquhar. He served as the New York Times Cairo bureau chief from 2001 through 2005. He is now the UN bureau chief. He grew up in Libya, and when he went to college, he got more and more interested in the history of the Middle East, studied Arabic, went back, worked as a reporter for the Associated Press, and has produced now two books, a novel, The Sand Cafe, which is about Gulf War correspondents marooned in a Saudi hotel, and his most recent is a journalistic piece based on his experience reporting in the Middle East, The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah Wishes You a Happy Birthday, Unexpected Encounters in the Changing Middle East, published by Public Affairs. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And back at the beginning, you explained about the title, the fact that when you were in Lebanon, Hezbollah is important enough so that you essentially have to register with them and give them various kinds of information. And one of the things that they got was your birthday. So, in fact, they did send you an e-card or an email, a greeting on your birthday. This, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about Hezbollah and Lebanon and how the rise of the importance and the influence within that country of Hezbollah, does it say something important, not just about Lebanon, but does it say something important about the entire Middle East?
I think, you know, I mean, that's one of the things I tried to look at in the book, because, you know, when I was a kid, I had this image of Lebanon as the playground, and you could swim in the Mediterranean, ski on the same day, and there you have this wonderful singer named Fairuz, who I came to know as an adult, who, you know, kind of tries to blend Western music with Arab poetry. But then you have this counterweight, which is Islam, and, you know, the rise of Hezbollah as trying to sort of create this sort of muscular nationalism. And the way I illustrate the story in the book also is kind of there's a fight over dairy cows. You know, the Americans are trying to get the hashish farmers of the Bekaa Valley, which is the interior of Lebanon, to stop growing hashish. And so they start this aid program, and they sell them dairy cows at like $2,000 a pop. you know, Hezbollah doesn't really want the Americans there, so they have a television station. So every time an American dairy cow gets sick, out go the television cameras, and they, you know, take pictures of it, and they put it on the evening news and say the Americans are dumping inferior cows on Lebanon. And in the meantime, the Iranians show up with cows that just cost $1,000 and that they say will produce more milk. So, you know, this geopolitical conversation that we see in the United States on the level of, you know, nuclear weapons and everything comes down to what cows produce more milk in the valley in Lebanon.
Mm-hmm. Well, that, I suppose, that also points to the fact that groups like Hezbollah have become very adept at using media to get out their message. And certainly we know that groups like that and others have used the internet. We do have Arabic language television now in that region. And I guess one of the things that I wonder about is if we had the opportunity to see more Arab media, to see how it is they reported about that part of the world and how it is that they covered some of the same stories that the Western media covered and no doubt covered them in a very different way, whether there were some important things that we could learn simply by really being plugged into Arab media.
Well, I think so. I mean, obviously there's a language barrier, although, you know, Al Jazeera broadcasts, you know, in news in English that covers the world. I think that's one of the things when I talk about the outside image versus the daily reality, and Al Jazeera would be a prime example, because in the United States it has sort of a reputation of being all Al-Qaeda all the time, and it's sort of heavily criticized by American officials for giving Osama bin Laden a platform. But there, you know, all the governments hate Al Jazeera because it also gives a platform for these dissidents, you know, who labored in obscurity for decades. So, you know, if they're doing a program on about political change in Libya or something like that, they'll bring on some Libyan dissident who's been hiding in London. And so I always kept the TV on because I would always find interesting people and interesting critics of the government whenever I had it on. And I think it's really kind of, it had a spillover effect, because to compete with that, government-owned television stations, and they're all government-owned, I mean, governments had a monopoly until satellites came along, they had to be more open, newspapers had to be more open. So something like Jazeera has been a real force for change over there, and that sometimes gets lost in its characterization here.
There seems, you know, there has certainly been a lot since 9/11. There has been an awful lot in our media, and journalists have written and scholars have written about a fundamental disconnect, lack of understanding, conflict, you know, whatever you want to call it, between the West, and I guess that means the United States and Europe mostly, and the Middle East and West Asia, where predominantly we're talking about people who are Muslim. And there, so much has been made of this culture clash stuff, as if to say here there are people who are coming from two fundamentally different places, from two different worlds, and that they have very different kinds of political philosophies and different ideas about what's really important and how people ought to live their lives, and that it's somehow a conflict that's just almost not resolvable. And I wonder how you see that conversation and that debate as someone who has actually lived there in the Middle East and lived there and grew up there, even in as much as you weren't, you know, you were living in a company town, but somebody who had lived there and then also spent several years there as a reporter. What do you think about this, the clash of civilizations kind of stuff that we've heard so much about?
I think it's kind of overblown. And I mean, you know, I think that, you know, there's no question that the spectacular violence over the past, you know, two or three decades, starting with the Iranian Revolution and, you know, the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait and 9/11 and the Palestinian uprisings against the Israeli occupation and the invasion of Iraq. I mean, there have been huge stories, but I think the book is kind of like the stories that I wanted to write as opposed to the stories that I had to write.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think our picture, because of that, those spectacular events, that the picture of the region is sort of mass gunmen and veiled women who, if they weren't mute, would say, "Rescue me." And I think it's too monochromatic. And I mean, I always like to give the example that's in the book of the chef, you know, the most popular chef in Lebanon, and he has this television show where he takes live calls from around the region. And one day, he had like 2 minutes to go, and a bee plopped into his white sauce. And so he takes the spoon and he wicks the bee out, and he said, "I should start over, but I can't because there's 2 minutes to go, so we're continuing." And the phones light up. And a woman calls from Saudi Arabia and says, "You told us that cleanliness was the most important thing and we have to be clean, and how could you do that and not start over?" And then the next caller was from Sudan, and she said, "You know, bees are mentioned in the Quran, that they have their own souls, they're very clean, you should have left the bee in there, it would have been no problem." And then they put a Syrian man on, and he said, "Do we have to bring the Quran into everything? Can't we just cook?" And, you know, there's a sort of all layers of conversation that go on in that region that we don't always listen to or hear.
Yeah. We have a caller here to talk with. Let us do that on our line number one, someone who is here in Champaign County, where we are, right here. Hello.
I don't know if you mentioned it explicitly, but when you were covering Al Jazeera's coverage, did you mention this this latest thing about the Bible thumpers in Afghanistan, one might say? I guess there's a Harper's cover story this week on the way the U.S. military is full of proselytizers, apparently, or at least has a fairly high quotient of them. And there's a to and fro between the Pentagon and the Al Jazeera about the legitimacy of the coverage, et cetera, et cetera.
There, you know, there's been a long-standing fight between the American administration and Al Jazeera over the years, and a lot of it stems from, you know, they think that Al Jazeera is overtly hostile to the United States, and in return, you know, like two Al Jazeera bureaus have been bombed, the one in Kabul and the one in Baghdad, and I think I'd like to differentiate between the news on Al Jazeera and the talk shows. And the news is fairly straightforward. There is something of an anti-American bias, and the you know, army officers in Iraq, for example, would object to the fact that they'd say that, you know, the Americans shot up a mosque and not say that there were snipers in the minaret and things like that. But they've also, while I was there, they had a strong commitment to broadcasting anything from the American government live. If the Secretary of Defense or the Secretary of State or the Vice President or the President was on, it was on live on Al Jazeera. I mean, even if it was in some place like Tokyo, you know, the Minister of Defense visiting Tokyo. And they would stay with it much longer than their Western counterparts. Now, that was on the news. The news was, you know, kind of news junkie's dream. On the talk shows, they would, you know, because it's sort of an opinion piece that they gave their columnists. And so there they would, you know, they'd bring in people like Lyndon LaRouche, who would spin these conspiracy theories about what was going on in the United States. And so that's where, you know, a certain amount of bias came in.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the U.S. Media is fairly, and I would maybe yourself excluded, I don't know, but particularly the visual media is particularly compliant with any kind of spin the Pentagon puts on it. I suppose I'll get a little bit of argument from you, but I mean, in America, I mean, the Al Jazeera knows that the UN didn't authorize the invasion of Iraq, for instance, but we still have a media that doesn't really emphasize that much, and we have a population that still believes, to a fairly high plurality, I guess, that the Iraq attack was authorized by the UN. Now, just as one example of how different it can be, you know. Al Jazeera has a bias against, perhaps we might say they have a bias against outsiders attacking an Arab country without any kind of authorization. The U.S. Doesn't really do that much self-examination. I suppose you might have done that occasionally in one of your articles. But anyway, the substance of this story about proselytizing Afghanis from inside the military is fairly astonishing. I guess the Pentagon actually burnt a bunch of Bibles, which I guess is going to cause some of the people on right wing TV to be totally outraged and predict the Antichrist, et cetera, et cetera. But the other point you mentioned earlier about sort of the opposition in countries that are supported by the U.S. that are dictatorships, say for Egypt, for instance, which is a virtual dictatorship, how easy is it for you to actually connect with people who don't come after the change in a Western mode. People inside the Brotherhood, I guess, might be a good example of that. How easy is it for you actually to get their stories and talk to them?
It's easy. I mean, you know, the brother. There's actually a whole chapter on the Muslim Brotherhood in the book, and I follow a candidate around, and the new generation of the Brotherhooders, the young generation, you know, they put out a few bloggers, and they raised quite a controversy in Egypt because they were talking about policies within the Brotherhood that they don't like. And in Egypt, it's strange because even the opposition parties have come to resemble the government. So, you know, the government has been in there since 1981, and the president's in his 80s, and, you know, on all the opposition parties, the leaders are 80 years old, and they will brook no challenge from the younger generation, and the whole system is kind of frozen and awful. And, you know, these young Muslim Brotherhoods were talking about movies on, you know, their blogs, and they were also talking about, you know, internal debates within the Muslim Brotherhood about slogans and policy, and the older generation was horrified and tried to shut them all down and said, you know, don't wash our dirty linen in public. So in terms of groups like that they kind of work in legal twilight. They're not legal, but the government tolerates them, and then it can crack down on them and say you're illegal if they get too powerful. Those people are fairly easy to reach. I mean, it's the people preaching violence that it's more difficult and, you know, more fraught with risk when you try and dig them up.
Okay, thanks.
Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest is Neil McFarquhar. He served as New York Times Cairo Bureau Chief from 2001 through 2005. Now is its United Nations Bureau Chief. Before that, worked for the Associated Press as a reporter in the region, and before that, grew up in Libya and has written about some of his experiences as a reporter in the region in his recent book, The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah Wishes You a Happy Birthday, Unexpected Encounters in the Changing Middle East, Public Affairs, the publisher. Questions certainly are welcome. One thing that I'd like to have you talk some more about is the role of religion in people's lives. It seems that on the one hand, perhaps to a much greater extent than here in the United States, that people are interested in the kind of guidance for their daily lives that religion provides. At the same time, one of the interesting things about Islam is that there's no centralized authority. There are a lot of different mm-hmm. people who are interpreting scripture and all of that, all of those things that were attributed to the prophet, things that people said he said, for that reason, it seems like the business sometimes the business of people figuring out okay how in some particular situation what's the thing to do gets very confused.
It is. There's another chapter on that in my Happy Birthday from Hezbollah book. And it's about fatwas. And you say fatwa to most Westerners, and if they recall any, it's the death sentence pronounced against Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran, against Salman Rushdie for his book, The Satanic Verses. And that's the one that's lodged in people's mind. But actually, people turn to the clergy all the time for fatwas, you know, sort of religious rulings to things to do, you know, about their sex life, whether, you know, about their business. Is it okay to say sell liquor in a hotel to tourists because Islam says liquor is forbidden? About politics, should I vote for this candidate? Should I vote for that candidate? And, you know, sort of progressives in the region are horrified by it because they think it's a step backwards and letting sort of conservative religious clerics dictate sort of the tenor of the society. But other people think, well, it's not such a bad thing. People are, you know, sort of feeling their way forward towards modernization, and if they're more comfortable doing it with religious direction, then maybe it's not so bad. You know, my favorite one is the fight in Iran between the clergy who want to ban dogs because, you know, in the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad, it sort of suggests or says that dogs are unclean. And so there's a lot of clergy that sees them as sort of a Western thing and they're unclean in Islam and nobody should have them. So every 2 years or so, they roll out these fatwas saying dogs should be banned. And, you know, and then people who don't like the Islamic Republic think, well, you know, I'm just going to stick it to them. I'm going to get a dog. And the tension goes back and forth, and it's hard to find dogs. And so I went down and I took a walk through the animal market, and people would come up whispering in my ear, and they'd say, I've got a German Shepherd. You want to buy a German Shepherd? Like it was drugs. So, I mean, fatwas are something that are just kind of omnipresent. But the problem is, in the current age, because you can get them on the phone now, you can get them on email, you can get them on television, like there's just this proliferation that causes an enormous amount of confusion about which are legitimate and which are not.
Well, then, is there any effort, or could there even be an effort, to try to have a more unified, common approach to various sorts of questions, both small ones and really much bigger ones, so that you don't have people essentially fatwa shopping, so that they can, whatever course of action they choose, they can try and find somebody who will say, yes, this is good, you can go out and do it?
You could try, but it's a little bit hard. You know, it's a little bit like some people, you know, like the equivalent might be Catholics, like they like to go to their parish priest and they go to confession, and they, you know, or Jews with a particular rabbi, you know, they feel a spiritual connection to that person, so they want to consult with him and they want to hear his individual opinion on things. And fatwas are to a certain extent like that, in that it you know, it's kind of an individual relationship. But it is true, like you said, there's fatwa shopping, and people who just kind of dip in occasionally. If they don't like the answer, they go find another sheikh. And so, you know, the senior clergy, like the senior cleric in Egypt, he's called the Grand Mufti is his title, he set up a special organization, you know, so it's the House of Fatwa, to issue rulings. And, you know, he said when he was first the Mufti, he got maybe 25 questions a day so he could answer them himself. I talked to him last fall, and he's up to 3,000 a day, you know, so he has a staff of 20 answering these questions. And so it's hard to kind of centralize because people have all this variety, and it also differs from country to country. You know, there's kind of a certain national jealousy about the religious hierarchies. So people do cross borders sometimes, but in each individual country, there's kind of, you know, one religious authority that wants to issue them.
Hmm. We have someone else to talk with, someone here in Sullivan, and on our toll-free line 4. Hello.
Yes, I went to Cairo in Egypt about 3 years ago, and I was talking to our guide, and he was talking about arranged marriages, which he said that a lot of people in colleges would hook up with somebody, and they would have a marriage, and when they broke up, they would just cancel the marriage. And he said that was probably a million people are doing that type of thing. And what I kind of gathered about the society was the fact that there is a lot of, formal rules, and then there's what really goes on to get around the rules that are not talked about a lot. And I'd like to hear you comment on that, and also the fact that in the Arab world, that we rarely hear about the high unemployment rate with the young population. I was reading the Herald Tribune. I was in Cairo, and it stated that the unemployment rate for people from 16 to 29 was something like 85%. And this is a country that is somewhat, doing well compared to some other countries in the Arab world. And I'm just... What we never hear about, you know, probably some of the major reasons that we have unrest in some of these countries, and then that they need a focal point to take away from the internal problems by external problems. And I'd like to hear your comment.
I think that's correct in that, the youth are unemployed and are lost. Actually, there was one of the, I was just talking about fatwas a minute ago and these religious rulings, and in Egypt there is a telephone service that you can call up and you can get a fatwa on the phone. It's called, one of the things that the cleric who ran it noticed was that there was a big uptick in the questions about sex, and he was a little bit surprised, and he said he thought people had time on their hands, and so they were finding, you know, ways to experiment in ways that hadn't been allowed before. And that kind of marriage that you mentioned, it's called an Orfi marriage, where you just get your own witnesses and do it and you don't register it, is one of the main examples of that. And but again, I think that you know, the things that we hear about and the things we don't, a part of it is the problem of coverage. Like, there was a sex therapist on Kuwaiti TV. She had a column in a newspaper, and she graduated to a TV show, a talk show on cable TV. And, you know, she's a devout Muslim woman, and she wears a headscarf, and she wears long clothes. I mean, she usually wears, like, long red leather, but it's still, it's modest dress. And I said, well, you know, how do you get away with that? I mean, how does the people react to a devout Muslim woman, you know, talking about sexual relations between husbands and wives on the air? And she said, are you kidding? A veiled woman talking about sex? They love it, sweetie. And I think that's one of the points that I try and get across in the book, is that there are a lot of facets to these societies that are, you know, that merit more attention.
Well, this, and we're coming down to, we have just maybe just about 5 minutes left, and I guess that's the kind of story that and I'm sure people like, and when you talked a little bit earlier about the fact that as a journalist, so much of the reporting that you had to do was about conflict, because that's, you know, that's the big story. That's what is stories. That's what makes stories, conflict. But that there were other kinds of stories that you wanted to have a chance to tell, that you thought it would be good for people to hear. And generally speaking, what stories are there? I mean, what is it that you would like for people here to hear or to understand, that for most of the time and most of the kind of coverage of the region that we get, there are stories that we're just not getting?
There's all kinds of things over there, you know, on the on some of the things I've talked about, you know, cooking, the political cartoons. You know, not all of them are happy stories. There are unfortunate stories that also don't get much coverage, too. Like, you know, there's a whole religious police force in Saudi Arabia that tries to make people follow the rules and traditions of Islam as the police force interprets them. And so, I met a woman who had been arrested by them because she was in her father's office. He was sick that day, and she went in to run the payroll, and someone called up the religious police, and, you know, they came and they found her, and they said, you're not related to any of these men, and, you know, they kind of slapped her around and threw her in jail for 3 days. So there are dark stories, too. But I just think that there is a lot that people could relate to more than just, a diet of violence.
For you make some interesting comments, I think, right in the end in your epilogue that are aimed at the United States and kind of aimed at the United States government, and suggestions about how it is that the kind of approach that we take to the region could be adjusted, so maybe it would be more productive. And one of the things, actually, I think you talked a little bit about earlier, was in how it is we think about, talk about the idea of democracy, how it is we go about promoting it, and that, in fact, that we can promote things that we think are important democratic values, and that there's perhaps a way to talk about it that will work better with the context that we're talking about than maybe some of the ways that we have tried to do it.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's all kinds of examples of that, and mostly at least it is related to, listening to what people there say and the way they criticize their societies and seeing if there's things we have in common. For example, the Saudi education professor.
Mr. McFarquhar, are you still there?
Hello?
We just sort of lost you for a second there.
Oh, sorry, I thought I'd lost you. Anyway, the Saudi education, I know we don't have much time. The
right.
Saudi education professor was talking about the level of religion in the textbooks, and she was saying, you know, there's religion, religion, religion all the time, and we need more math, we need more science, we need more people that would be more productive. So, you know, the United States could question, you know, where are the Microsofts, where are the Apple computers, where's the innovation, instead of trying to confront them and saying, you know, there's too much, because there was after 9/11, there was this sense that, you know, the education system and the curriculum was fostering extremism. So the United States said, you have to take your religion out of your textbooks, and then it became a confrontation over culture and religion, and the U.S. is against Islam, and so it turned a lot of people off. But if you kind of just twisted that and made the criticism the way that, you know, Arab parents make the criticism, it would be stronger, and it would sort of put the governments on the spot to answer more than just saying, oh, the United States is attacking us culturally.
And if the United States really did want to support reformist elements within some of these societies, what would be the best way to do that?
I think that you don't endorse individuals, you don't endorse organizations, you just endorse principles. You say that, you know, when, you know, Ayman Nour ran against Hosni Mubarak in Egypt and he managed to somehow get 7% of the vote, you know, which is an enormous number, although very small. And, you know, immediately the government turned around and threw him in jail. And you don't signal out Ayman Nour and you say you should let him go because then everyone thinks Ayman Nour is a stooge of the United States. You say, you know, people have the right to, the political process should be open. People have the right, should have the right to challenge dictators that have been there forever. Political parties should have the right to operate. And you just kind of help create the building blocks of civil society.
So do you think that we're at a point here where we might see significant kind of change, really, and change coming up from the bottom and in ways that maybe we, here again, I'm sort of viewing it from our own perspective, but that we would think would be more progressive, that kind of change within the next 5, 10, 15 more years?
It's very hard to predict because everybody, you know, this is another thing that I talk about in the book. Everyone had kind of high hopes that this repressive societies were just sort of a symptom of the generation that came of age after World War II, and all these army officers sort of followed the lead of Gamal Abdel Nasser, and they took over their countries, and they created these secret police agencies with Soviet help, and sort of the model was going to die with that generation. But, you know, we see this new generation of younger leaders in their, you know, 35 to 40 range coming in, and they've spent time in the West, and, you know, they're not changing. They're trying to preserve the system that their fathers kept. So it's not something automatic that you can be optimistic about. But I think certainly with the opening up of the world in terms of, you know, people being more aware of on TV and just sort of being conscious that the Arab world is out of step, there's certainly beginning to be a consensus that there needs to be change. But it's hard because they don't have those tools, and I think that's how outsiders can help, is they can help them create the tools, and then by that I mean political parties and free press and things like that, that would allow that sentiment to grow.
All right.
But it's hard to put a date on it.
The book we've been talking about, The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah, wishes you a happy birthday by our guest, Neil McFarquhar. He is now the UN Bureau Chief for the New York Times. You want to read an excerpt from his book, go to the website of the Daily Beast, or you can go to his own website and find out more about him, neilmcfarquhar.com. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.